Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Welcome to the podcast. As with me, as always, is Michael Hamilton. Michael, how are you today?
I'm very good.
And today we've got a very special guest. We've got Matt Jones. Matt has been the co-founder and CEO of Oboe Mobile, seemingly exited from there, and is now working on Source AI as the CEO as well, which is basically a forecasting prediction AI company, helping businesses drive through intelligent decisions, making more components for their customers and also on the marketing side as well. So Matt, a very big welcome to you.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me. And nice to see you, Mike.
Pleasure.
Awesome. So jumping straight into it, Matt, tell us a bit of background. Obviously, you know, you've been very successful in starting up, you know, Oboe Mobile and seemingly exiting that and moving now into the AI space with Source. So what took you through in your career to this position where you are now?
Well, I started in the telco industry, you know, working as a BA when I got out of university, and then up into sort of management, I guess, layers across the principally the technology part of telco, more so than marketing or product, and then pivoted into product, then left the telco industry after about, I don't know, 10 years or so, and went into management consulting and, you know, flew around the world doing telco systems replacements or what was early on called digital transformation, but it's not kind of what it is today, just putting websites in front of platforms and those sorts of things, portals. And then I went into the software industry and did for 4 or 5 years as global product management for a company that was ultimately bought by ABB, and then pivoted into sales in gave up the kind of big certain salary for the uncertain but really big upside opportunity, and I fell in love with software. It was kind of, I don't know, you know, eating the world, as is often referred to, and I just sort of saw a huge opportunity to do cool stuff with software. And then the actual genesis of Ovo was we wanted to run a software platform for a big media company in Australia, you know, that would enable them to become a mobile company. So bring their content onto our platform, and then we would do all the operations of the platform with the telco carrier and create the first media telco in the Australian market. And so we ran around talking to all the big media companies, and we weren't very successful actually convincing them to do it. There's a lot of barriers to their shift to become a subscription business. So that led us to saying, you know what, stuff it, we'll just start our own mobile media brand. And so we launched Ovo, you know, toiled away for 5 years. It's hard yakka in those sort of, when you're a tiny unknown brand and building a customer base and getting to profitability. But you know, we got to about 88,000 subscribers before we sold the company to Amaysim, just bang on the beginning of COVID. And in that journey, you know, going back to kind of the software roots, we acquired an AI machine learning company because we wanted to do personalization of our user experience. For the first time in a long time, I was kind of back working in the software industry with these amazing data science guys, engineers, on personalization recommendations. They then applied some of their techniques to some of the bigger KPIs for the telco, like churn and yield management and acquisition efficiency. We had some amazing impacts there on the Ovo business. And then ultimately we sold the mobile business, and, you know, we've shrunk the team from 30 people back down to 6. And we're taking that platform we developed over the 2 or 3 years that we were operating it for Ovo to market as a SaaS platform for subscription industry that's trying to implement machine learning and AI to drive their key KPIs.
Fantastic. And obviously we've also come, I guess, from that telco background where it's been very competitive, especially within Australia, and, you know, every subscriber is a real fight for it. So the interesting thing with Source, obviously, when you acquired that AI and ML, you had a good chance to flesh it out within Ovo, because a lot of the stuff you guys did was very, very tailored compared to the rest of the telcos, which was simply looking at data plans. Whereas you guys did a lot of experience things, you know, sort of acquiring sports rights for things that were less sort of seen in mainstream, and really targeting your customers that way as well.
Yeah, spot on. It was really about, telco's become such a commodity now, and we really only flip carriers for price or, to some extent if our coverage is rubbish, but we find it's pretty much the same with any of them. And so we were trying to differentiate with content. And so we figured if we acquired sports rights in smaller communities rather than, we were never going to afford the NRL or the AFL rights. So we targeted things like water polo and gymnastics and drag racing, which went off like a firecracker. It was huge. Professional wrestling, like Australia's version of WWE, And the interesting thing about sports is it's kind of communities of really passionate people, like smaller than obviously the AFL and NRL fan base, but still very, very passionate. And so the principle was to do something that people are passionate about and kind of overcome the commoditization of the telco service. And then our way of linking up the telco service to the content was you could stream all of this live sport, whether it was the drag racing or the wrestling, and it wouldn't use your data plan. So we had kind of built a real-time data unmetering platform that sat over the top.
So you're kind of paving the way for what I guess the big guys are trying to do now in regards to personalization, especially, once COVID's hit and everyone's gone much more from a remote working and much more data heavy, they're now obviously trying to look at different ways to look at their subscribers. So you guys have kind of been ahead of the curve in that respect as well.
Yeah, I think, in the old marketing days, we used to define segments, which, would be fairly rigid. And we would sort of go, okay, this is the youth and this is university students, or however we defined our segments, families, young families, often using geographic and demographic data. So we'd say, higher net worths, lower net worths. But the truth is a lot of that segmentation is quite arbitrary and fixed. And what a lot of our machine learning and AI does is use much more behavioral data to define who you are and what you're interested in. So things like, if I'm watching wrestling, what other content might I be interested in? How do I discover new stuff? How do I make sure I'm aware of when the next thing I'm interested in is coming up? Really trying to re-engage people back into your platform and in your environment, if you know what I mean. So that our mission was to kind of hyper-personalize, do what we as consumers have always wanted cable TV to do, is just give me the stuff I want, right? I don't want a package with 500 channels when all I'm really interested in is this sport and this sort of entertainment service. So we were hyper-personalizing using machine learning and AI to understand behavior.
Your product speaks to me. I know when I was working at Vodafone, I was working on the business intelligence department, and customer engagement and avoiding churn is those metrics that we talked about every day. Yeah. But your product really, or your service really targets that area. Is that the common conversation you have a lot with your clients?
Yeah, and actually you're right, Michael. Those two things are actually linked, right? Because if you're really engaged with a brand, whether it's a telco, just you're more frequently considering the brand or considering the service in a good way, right? Not like, frustrated with it every week. But if you're sort of like, oh, I might see if they've got any offers, or I might check if they have a product that fits my needs. If that's really easy in a digital sense and really personalized, you put their value to you higher in kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, And so the things we were doing was like, we have our machine learning models also run on the edge on the device. And without getting spooky, what we do is we can understand your patterns of behavior. So things like, what time do you leave home? How do you travel by bus, train? How long do you travel for? What time do you get to work? Is your work kind of the sort of job where you check your phone throughout the day, like a typical white collar role, or are you up on the 50th floor of a building construction site and you're hopefully not using your mobile? So we learn all these patterns right down to the individual, and then we look at the content that you've been consuming and the way you use your mobile, and we personalize and select content that's relevant to you, and then we just engage with you in those moments when you're looking for something to do. So the principle would be, last night's NRL game was on, you possibly didn't see it all or watch it, and you jump on the bus in the morning and the 20-minute highlights is pushed to you as a notification just as you hop on the bus. And you can watch those highlights and therefore re-engage with the experience of being part of having a connection with the brand. And so when we did that, when we kind of, it's what they call contextual behavioral analytics. So we know your context of what you're doing. When we did that, we would lift re-engagement. So people coming back into the app by about seven times. And then the net of that would be that they'd spend probably our average watch time. So the average time that people would spend in our apps was about 8 minutes before we applied these techniques and these tools. And then after about 6 months, we were up at about 45 minutes. So people were coming back in and experiencing the OVO brand more frequently and then spending longer with us. And in the new, as they say, attention economy, if you're an ad-funded business or you're just trying to retain customers longer, those sorts of metrics are massive impact to an ad-funded business, for example.
And the core business at the moment or industries, is it media and telcos or is it just...
Yeah, yeah, because one of the byproducts of building it building the platform for OVO was that we had to address both the media use cases and the telco use cases. And that meant building what's known as a unified data model for those two industries. So how do you bring all the data together and structure it for machine learning for the KPIs those industries care about? So we're going to market with those two industries already nailed. And then there's kind of a natural expansion into other subscription industries where they have a similar set of KPIs. I mean, the KPIs between a telco and, say, a utility, a power utility, are not massively different. Not to suggest they're identical because they have heavier regulatory intervention. Pricing is fixed. Frankly, the churn, the reasons you churn with your energy are different than telco. Telco is driven by the cycles of device releases and Christmas giving, those sorts of cyclical things, whereas most of the energy churn is driven by, would you believe it, moving house event. Like, we don't really think about it until we go, oh shoot, I've got to think of an energy provider, I'm just either moving into a new rental property or bought a new house or whatever. So there's different triggers and different influences, but the principles are still the same. Energy retailers and telcos want to retain their customers longer, they want to engage them more so that they actually get more utility out of the service. And I guess energy retailers, as an example, have other cool stuff like solar and demand side management, being able to control your devices in your house and influence your power consumption, green energy sort of services. So yeah, there's different differences between each industry, but some commonality. And broadly speaking, any subscription business, whether it's monthly, quarterly or annual, could apply these techniques and these machine learning models. We just have to adjust and create a universal data model for each one of them.
So you guys have been very successful in building out the models and almost providing, like, I guess, an integrated platform for people to plug in their data sources, whether that's a Salesforce or, you know, some custom API and put it into the models. In your experience, Matt, how mature do you think the AI and ML industry is within the Australian market? Like, you guys have done very well. Was it a hard slog though to kind of get there at the start, or did you manage to find the right people and move forward?
Oh, we haven't nailed it yet. Just we're still full startup here. I mean, we turn over about $1 million in revenue through a tens of clients, not hundreds. By no means are we kind of home and hose and off to the races for the global domination. But coming back to your question, I think it depends. You know, how mature is machine learning? Well, it really depends by industry and by what, or and AI generally, what you mean by AI in that industry. So, I mean, speaking on a couple of industries we know quite a bit about, in the media industry, a lot of the activity has been focused on that personalization, on the user experience, to some extent, behavioral analytics, so that you can predict and understand what people are interested in, but it all comes back to serving the right content to the right audience. And I'm mostly talking about subscription really here, because free to air is more about picking the right masthead broadcast formats to entertain during the schedule, if you know what I mean, alongside sport. And actually, in many respects, the way that people in that industry have adopted ML has been largely about buying ML built into a software platform. So if you have a video platform and you want to enable recommendations, it's using the machine learning, if you could call it that, capability that's been developed by the video platform vendor. as opposed to, you know, kind of very purposely developed ML tools for that purpose. In telco, so the maturity there is, I mean, it's only really applying to the user experience. The question would be, gosh, imagine if media companies could work out exactly what content to go get. That what's the next Game of Thrones? And you know, these things are really, really big bets. So understanding the horizon of interest for the fans, and therefore when they go out and spend millions and sometimes billions on content deals, they know exactly how many fans are going to want to subscribe and engage, and how tastes are changing. And in the media subscription industry, you know, if you take things like Netflix and Stan and others, in the globals like Netflix, you know, I think I saw a stat that something like 75% of all videos watched on Netflix are a recommendation. So even though you're scrolling around and going, oh, you know, I might watch this, the whole user interface is being hyper-personalized to you, even if you feel like you're looking in genres. Inside the genre rail, the priority ones on the three left-hand side are all prioritized to your personal tastes and your behavior. And I think another stat Netflix quote is that they say that their machine learning or their AI practice saves them about $1.5 billion annually in curation costs, because humans just could not scale to provide that personalization. So that space is done. I wonder though whether media companies, subscription media companies, have spent quite as much time on predicting and understanding things like churn. How do I cross sell and upsell other services? You know, who in the Netflix space should be pushed recommendations around premium services, whether it's HD, 4K, multi-home, you know, all those other opportunities. And certainly here locally in Australia, I suspect, you know, beyond Stan, there's not a great deal of subscription media propositions, and so therefore probably fairly immature in that sense. Telcos, totally different kettle of fish. They've spent a huge amount of time because they're quite, they've got quite complex systems, as we all understand if we've worked in that industry, and normally more than one of everything. So they've spent a huge amount of time on RPA, robotic process automation, and fair enough too. That's where most of their cost sits, outside their network. And only, you know, only the biggest carriers have machine learning practices with data scientists in residence working on models relating to things like churn and yield. But you come down one layer from the network carriers, and you'd be surprised to find more than, you know, most cases there's no data scientist team. You know, it's really smart people who have a lot of industry experience, but they, you know, they're probably toiling away with the Amazon and Azure and Google suite to try and build out some capability around data science. But, you know, for the most part, they're not full data science practices that have been working for years. So fairly immature in that sense.
That's an interesting point you also raise, in that a lot of these decisions are being sort of, you know, made manually by people with experience. So is it a case sometimes where people are going to build the model out, look at the results and go, oh, geez, really? Do I go that path, or do I just stick with what I know? Is there kind of that fear factor? Like when you guys first did it with OVO, was that, you know, that sort of fear of trying something new, using AI and ML to build a model and then trusting the results and going with it? Was that sort of, you know, in the back of your mind as, hey, do we go with it or do we trust our gut?
I don't want to be flippant, but truth is we acquired the company for a fair sum. We had three PhD research data scientists, you know, and these guys have been researching machine learning and personalization for years. So I felt fairly underqualified to determine whether or not it was going to work. So we just, but what they do, which is quite, you know, obvious, I guess, is they experiment and test and compare. So everything's an A-B test, you know, because, you know, they want to validate for themselves that it works before you apply it to every user. So very quickly, using the platform, we're able to determine those metrics I shared with you, plus any negatives, you know, does it cause uninstalls? Does it annoy people? All those sorts of things. But very quickly, we're able to measure the material difference between a control group and those that were getting the recommendation. And that's how all data science is proven, really, is always having that A-B testing in place. I think the other thing, though, was once we got confidence, then the real trick is joining the industry knowledge to the data science techniques, because broadly speaking, you know, data scientists are experts in certain techniques and often tools, but they, because they haven't worked all their lives in one industry, they really need the industry context. So you've got to join the understanding of the KPIs, what influences the KPIs, because really a model is just a mathematical equation using features and working out what features matter more than others, right? And seeing the patterns. And so if you don't help the data science team understand the features that matter more, at least, and then test it and validate, often what will happen is you get those experiments that go nowhere. And you find that a lot in the bigger data science practices in brands where they've got tons of projects running and the executive are like, yeah, but we're getting no benefit. And that's because often they've left data science separate from the actual people who understand the business processes and the business metrics that matter.
So is that, in your mind, then a case where people probably need to be a bit more business savvy when applying this as opposed to just technically focused? So like you said, if you've got a big practice, data scientists, if they're left alone with no interaction between the people on the front line, whether that's your CSRs, your BDMs, whatever it might be, then you're not really going to see the benefit. And do you see maybe that's why some people get a bit sort of, you know, funny about this area, because they haven't really invested the time themselves to help it grow?
Yeah, the most mature businesses adopting AI, and more specifically in my case, machine learning models into their that drive key KPIs. Let's take churn, for example. They will set up almost a practice which has, from business leadership through to data engineering, data wrangling, data science, and think of it as like a little silo that's lined up to the KPI. And that way they ensure they get the full business context and a business case for the investment and the measurement and the proof end to end, rather than like some horizontal data science practice where you chuck random problems at it. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, a couple of the bigger telcos do that. They line up their it's all, almost like that squad mentality. I'm going to create the churn squad, the yield squad, the customer retention squad, the customer acquisition squad, and it's got a full, almost autonomous business and data science and data management set of skills in it, so that it can be measured against its KPI, which is to improve the KPI that it's defined to be addressing. But you actually asked another question there, which I think is really interesting, which is around you know, how do they experiment a bit more with the potential use of machine learning? And on top of our platform, which does the major machine learning models for those key KPIs, we've built out what I think is the first for subscription industry scenario planning tools. And the best way to describe those is kind of like airlines. They've for years had tools to allow them to optimize route, fuel, passengers, tickets, weather, and go, you know what, if we want to get from here to Denmark, it's best to go via Dubai on Wednesday, the 18th of November, because of the weather and this cargo route and the cost of this and the ticket prices and all those sort of dimensions. So we've effectively done the same for the subscription industry, so that the models can all be used at once against all the key KPIs to optimize decisions before they're made by executives. And that way, every decision you make, whether it's a pricing change or a product change or a launch of a new marketing campaign, you can almost forecast out the impact using historic data. And so you can give yourself confidence that you're going the right direction, or adjust it slightly. So you can run the scenarios infinitely, right? You know, do 100 scenarios and work out what's the best way to launch this product, what's the best pricing response to that competitor's action.
And you're finding, we've been talking to some students the last couple of years also in the data science space. Now, you mentioned before in going, don't have the industry knowledge. So getting the data scientists, the people who are maybe studying at the moment, to come in to a business like yours or go into a corporate to talk to the business, should they be challenging the business with the data that they find or the findings in the models? Or does the business not trust the model sometimes?
A bit of all of the above. I mean, our chief data scientist, Hendrik, I can recall when we first said, hey, Hendrik, can you have a look at churn? Right. And, you know, he understands the telco industry like any consumer, but hadn't worked in it. So he went away I'm going to give you the business version of this because I can't describe the tools he used. I could say a bunch of words and other data scientists would know what I'm talking about, but I don't. But he used a range of techniques and he came back to us and we went through, I swear to God, a 45-page PowerPoint of insights. And what happened was we were like, yeah, we know all that. as business people, we were like, yeah, of course they churn because of A, B, and C. So then it was actually a realization that we needed to say, actually, our hypothesis is that if this, and this were true, we would have a much higher proportion of customers that would churn in this segment or this cohort. And then Henry went away and reapplied the techniques to understand if our hypothesis was wrong. It was partly right and partly wrong. And then we discovered two or three other things that were kind of adjacent to our original hypothesis. And that became how you kind of iterate the quality of the churn model. Is you can't just chuck a problem over the fence to somebody who doesn't know what the key influencing factors are. Otherwise you'll get back possibly what you already know, or you'll get back something spurious and you'll go, I don't even really trust that. That doesn't seem logical as somebody who's worked in the industry for 20 years. So if I'm a young student, so to speak, or graduate coming out with the data science skills, I'm trying to recall your question, Michael, but I suspect it was sort of like, how would they best connect into a data science practice that's serving it in a business? It's quite possibly like anything, you know, you want to have a bit of time where you're sitting alongside people who have been doing it for a little while in that context. So, you know, bring the new skills and the new thinking and bright young people have got that kind of new ways of thinking about things, but also get some time working with some people who are already addressing key problems and can kind of save you from these are all the things we've tried to know and this is actually where we're headed and why. And then you get the best of both the experience and the new skills and techniques.
Fantastic. And also, a lot of people we talk to are scared to use models or algorithms or, you know, machine learning because their data's so dirty or not clean or got gaps in it. Now, do you account for that? Because obviously in telco, Carl and I have worked and we've seen it. For example, data birth, missing data births across the board, right? Yeah. What happens if you don't have 30% of those in the database? You know, what does that mean to your models?
Yeah, well, that good question. So the first question is, what do you do about data disparity and bringing it together? And, you know, most people now are getting their act together around getting their data into a data lake, even if they don't necessarily know how they're going to use it. And that's kind of step one, I guess. Those that have active projects applying machine learning, they then need to do the structuring. And that's when you discover that the system over there that captures new orders, you know, over that on that website doesn't capture data birth. Or it's not a mandatory field, and so 30% of all that acquisition doesn't have date of birth. And the question really then becomes to the data scientist, how important is that feature in the model? Because if it has a material impact on the model's accuracy or prediction, then either you have to carve that cohort out or adjust the model to address that, you know, in terms of the prediction accuracy of that cohort of customers. So missing data is a common challenge, whether it's, you know, just through often data extraction routines out of core systems may not have caught certain data in history. Often that's just a signal to the organization to go back and either fill out that data and or plug the hole, right? Make sure you're not ongoing missing that data. But applying the technique, it doesn't necessarily mean, to your question, it doesn't necessarily mean blowing up the model because you don't have that data. It just means adjusting the model's ranking of those features for that cohort to adjust to that scenario where it's missing some data. But part of what our platform's designed to do is to make it really easy for people in the subscription industry to not have to do all that data structuring and then the machine learning on top, because we can, for example, plug directly into a data lake or a source system, and then our universal data model, we can generally apply and restructure your data ready for machine learning within 30 days, for example, because we know exactly the data we need that drives predictability in those key KPIs for those industries, versus give us everything and we'll see what we can work out. We don't have to do the kind of discovery that often a brand might have to do if they're starting out.
One of the things we used to do, and I'm sure you remember this, Matt, is, you know, when sort of designing a new plan or you know, new config or whatever else, we'd look at the market and go, oh, you know, you've got Gen Ys using Facebook. Okay, we can lure some in by offering a free data plan or free access to this platform through whatever else. Now, a lot of that's kind of changed with this technology, where we've seen even banks now offering, you know, variable rate loans based on your circumstances, on, you know, your repayments history and everything else. So do you think that's kind of the future as well, this hyper-personalization within each industry? And, like, you know, I guess tools like yours, like Source, are designed to help with that, to create sort of a bit of a plan for everyone almost.
Yeah, I mean, often, great question, Carl. Often you just step back for a second, you go, as a consumer, would I like to have everything personalized to exactly what I want? Well, God damn it, yes, I would. Like, I would rather not buy the extra large size, you know, McDonald's meal just because I don't want the chips or the this. And so, you know, the reality is, of course, we want everything personalized. The problem for brands and retailers is it's not economic to, you know, create a T-shirt size for every single person, right? So the question then becomes, in digital experiences, to what extent can I enable that personalization without overloading the consumer with choice? Because if I give them too much choice, often they opt out of making a choice at all, right? So we're always struggling with this sort of small, medium, large model, which we know is about the optimal size, optimal number of choices for a consumer to make a choice, and hyper-personalization. And I think the big shift is going from that traditional model of segmentation and analytics to weighting in the models a lot more of what's generally called behavioral data. So if I can understand more about you and your interests and your patterns of behavior, I can personalize either the way I communicate, as you're sort of the example you're giving on Facebook, or the product itself. But in some cases, to be realistic, the product, there's other challenges to personalizing the product. So you can have a variable rate, and that's totally legitimate in banking. It's taking into account your circumstances, your income, your debts, your all those sorts of things to work out what's the optimal rate for you and all the market forces. But in certain industries like telco, alongside any product, pardon me, there's a regulatory requirement to have a, you know, 6-page customer information document, right? So you can't just quickly offer variable pricing when you've got to get a 6-page document completed for every single user. Or maybe you can, if you could dynamically create that document and publish it at the same time as offering the dynamic pricing, wouldn't that be cool? But my point is, you have to sometimes operate within the constraints, but there's ways to personalize product that doesn't mean constraining it to 3 choices, to use that obvious example. It could be simple things like what patterns does Matt have? You know, we'll use telco as an example, or even energy. You know, why do I have to keep my energy supply on when I'm on holidays for 2 weeks overseas? Or why can't I just keep it on for one part of the house, the pool, because I've got to keep that from turning green? You know, why can't I personalize based on some of the things I know about some of those users so that they can optimize to their patterns and they can have some control after just buying that consumptive product? Or in the telco industry, you know, adding what you can do a lot more than just the base product, which is, you know, let's face it, you want to get the highest possible average revenue per user or ARPU by having a subscription that people set and forget about, but then provide a whole lot of variable things that they can bolt on and package up with their service. You know, packaging up data-free Netflix, you know, phone subscriptions, content subscriptions, etc. So, you know, personalization, absolutely, probably the most important goal, I would say, nowadays, because those who know us better seem to get a lot more of our money. You know, Facebooks get a lot more advertising than print, for example. And I shop on Amazon more frequently than I do, say, eBay, because I can A, find, search for something, and B, the relevance of the recommendations alongside the search is so much better. So I know I'm more likely to get to the best product for me than if I go on eBay and randomly get a big long list of stuff that might or might not be relevant. So yeah, personalization's killer. We just got to be realistic about where you apply it. It might just be in the user experience. It might be the quality of the product. It might be in pricing, but it could be in other dimensions.
And that's interesting you mentioned that, because that was the one thing I think we spoke about with Dennis Chan when we had him on earlier, who does obviously, you know, object recognition and character recognition, where he was saying the problem that a lot of people see is that AI is this broad spread technology, when in reality, the way that he looks at it is it's applied intelligence for a particular cause. So AI models, for example, that you work on, if you know, for marketing and telco, aren't going to work for the retail shop or the clothing manufacturer, that all of it needs to be tailored specifically for a cause and purpose effect as well.
Yeah, that's right. There's a great article by Andreas Horowitz on the A16Z website, which sort of says AI software is somewhere in between consulting and traditional SaaS, right? Because you can't just buy a subscription to AI, plug it in, the model just goes, oh yeah, you're a retailer in clothing, so this will all just apply this. You've got to very much tune it. And to date, largely AI has been consulting. People are now building products, but the products are very specific to the use case and the purpose. And you know, what we're trying to do is take that a level further, which is go, okay, you could buy a churn model service from a churn platform provider, or we could develop all across all the key use cases for a telco. So that industry specificity is really powerful. And I think that's kind of the halfway between the horizontal SaaS process-based platform and consulting and or tools used to do specific things. For example, we're doing a project at the moment for a big media broadcaster that does podcasts. So kind of relevant to this conversation. And their challenge is, if you think about podcasts, discovering, the way we discover other podcasts now is pretty crude, right? It's either the top 10 list or other tech podcasts. So say we were watching yours and we're like, hey, you know, what other tech podcasts are there? It'd be searching by title. But the truth is, a podcast, whether it's video or audio, is actually a lot more about the subjects discussed inside the each session. Like your chat with Dennis is different than with me and whoever. And so what if you could create topics out of the discussion? So what we're doing is using NLP, we're ingesting all of the audio podcasts, using sentiment analysis and a range of other techniques, working out what is the main subjects we discuss. So AI would be a very big sort of theme if you think of a topic cloud, because we've said it a lot and we've probably said it with higher velocity in our voice than something boring. But there'll be other things we talked about, whether it's industries like telco, and I might be watching another podcast about telco. And if I could join that podcast to this podcast about AI and telco, I get this kind of discovery of stuff that's much more specific about the subject I was watching or listening to on the other podcast. So we're effectively creating the metadata using a technique, NLP, to Dennis's point, that's very specific to audio, to then create an experience of discovery so that that big brand can create the, what else should I listen to or watch out of the subjects in a spoken word podcast like this or video cast like this.
What I've been finding with talking to companies the last couple of years particularly is that they own their data. Their data is theirs, right? And I don't want to share it. If you are going down the machine learning or AI route, do you need to have more strategic partnerships, for example, supermarkets, telcos, utilities, working together with their data sets? Is that something that's you're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't that be great? I mean, it's a really complex I mean, yes, wouldn't it be great if we could put all the data together and everyone could be better? There's competitive issues there. There's privacy issues, to just name a couple. And then there's the issue of, you know, well, going to the competitive point, I want to use other tools, but I need to make sure that I'm not, you know, creating a problem for myself in privacy. So those tools need to come into my environment. One of the things we do, which is kind of interesting on this parallel, is for the telco industry where we've got telco clients, we use RPA, robotic process automation, to scrape all the competitors' pricings, products and promotions across the market. And we bring that into our platform, not to just show you who's got a better product, but to use that to influence the machine learning model and understand where your competitiveness fits in the market. Because, as I said a lot earlier, a lot of the competitive pricing and product behavior drives churn in the telco market, as opposed to things you do to yourself. So that market context, you know, you have to go out and source that data yourself and bring it into your platform for your purposes, in order to apply it to your outcomes. I guess there's open government and data sharing, you know, things starting to emerge so that you can understand more about the population and geographic and demographic data to build better products. That's bringing that together. The trick is to, it has to be super regulated and cared for it to be used effectively. We do a thing on all of the data that comes into our platform is depersonalized and GDPR compliant, therefore GDPR compliant. And we do that because if you don't do that, no one wants to use your platform. And frankly, we don't need your name and address and your email address to be able to understand the features of your behavior. That's that, as long as we depersonalize, and can, you know, on the other side of the transactional side, when we go back and provide you the output of that data back into your systems of execution, as long as we can translate that back and match it to the user for you on your side, we can be an independent platform that doesn't necessarily need to sit inside the client's infrastructure. But long way of saying, yeah, look, the more data, open data sharing possible, the better, but it comes with a huge number of political and, let's face it, competitive issues, right? As soon as you sort of go, you know, I want this for my benefit, but somebody else is going to benefit from my data, you get all of that constraint to that. So I don't see that necessarily changing overnight just because it would be better.
No, it totally makes sense. No, it's, yeah. It's a challenge that needs to be overcome, but it'll take time and it needs to be unregulated, of course. No, it's a good point. Yeah, I like it.
The other thing I wanted to talk about as well with you, Matt, was, I mean, you've been very instrumental in building a lot of companies up to a success point and moving on and from a sale perspective. So one of the areas we've been talking about with a lot of people in the region is around sort of the VC investment areas for startups in Australia and scale-ups. Now, obviously, you're involved with ACS at the moment, who have their own scale-up program. But outside of that, how do you find the maturity, like when you're out sort of talking to investors for over, I know there's a few late nights, you know, we'd have a chat and you'd be out sort of putting texts together, you know, probably done hundreds of presentations. So, I mean, was it a bit of a slog for you guys, you know, getting to where you wanted to get to?
Yeah, it's never easy. I don't think, I mean, anybody who kind of looks at the pitch deck for Airbnb and goes, you know, they pitched it once and then the next, if you've heard that podcast, it's famous because they stuffed around for 18 months or 2 years before they got any traction. but, you know, none of the startup capital raising that I've across the various companies has been easy. And particularly in Australia, because there's just this massive gap between seed and let's call it, you know, A rounds. Everyone's looking ironically for some, you know, hyper high growth scale up story for them to invest. And, you know, with not reflecting on any particular party, but typically the VC investment, it's, you know, it's expensive money and it comes with some fairly material terms often in relation to your control of the company and the destiny of that company. And, you know, one reflection I have from all, like, we've raised all types of different instruments too, right? From from VC, from high net worths to venture debt to convertible notes. And one of the things I think we ought to be a little, you know, as startup capital raising folks, be a little bit more okay with is scaling profitably if we can, particularly in Australia, because, you know, let's face it, there's only 20 something million of us. So you're not going to go from, you know, 100,000 to 1 million to 20 million in 3 years unless you go international. And so possibly the right thing to do is to prove that this business in itself can sustain itself before you take the 10 million Series A with a 100 times growth ambition. So it's a long way of saying that the corner store, grocery store, we don't have to do it over 100 years like, you know, our nan and grandfather did building up that franchise, but we could be a little bit more patient with the expectations we have and prove out our platform, its scalability, its value to clients, particularly in B2B software rather than consumer businesses. Because, you know, if you raise a lot of money in a number of series to stay alive, trust me, in 2 or 3 years, you'll be sitting there going, why am I doing this? I've got like 15% of the company left and I've got, you know, it's a good little business, but, you know, I didn't start this to be pre-Series A with 10 or 15 or 20% of the company. So what's that summary point? I guess in Australia, unless you kind of launch overseas for your Series A or your VC round, then maybe there's a case for being a bit more patient with your growth and raising just the right amount of money without any punitive terms from seed and high net worths and family offices who are kind of a little bit more on the support your profitable growth strategy. Because look at what's happened with COVID, right? You know, it's not sort of all coming out yet, but a lot of the startups are going to fall over because they didn't have a sustainable business model to start with. You know, it was going to get funded for 3 years and then it was going to pop and then they would do Series A. But I'm a bit more of a fan, just having gone through all of this experience multiple times, of a bit more of a build up a sensible business at its foundations without being so aggressive to try and scale in the first year or two and take a whole lot of punitive terms in your money raise, in your capital raising.
Does the investment community, you feel, in Australia need a little bit more education around investment and innovation, you know, cutting edge stuff? Do you find that's the case, or is it just a matter of there's better returns elsewhere for some other things?
God, that's a good question. I might answer it a different way, which is I think the biggest missed opportunity in Australia, being an island country, is corporate involvement in startup and scale up. You know, the amount of times you see a project happening in any big brand in any industry, which is sort of starting from scratch off the back of a startup that has developed some techniques, tools and platform or capability that was looking for support from that brand to scale it or to prove it out. So, you know, I think less about education perhaps of the investor community, which is pretty small, let's face it. It's not millions of people running around like Silicon Valley looking for kind of cool things to get into. You've got to go through all these various, whether it's Sydney Angels or Melbourne Angels, or into various cohort groups and find those seed investors. And then from there, find the network to get to the high net worth investors or family offices, or jump straight into the VC pitch and most often find yourself, more often than not, find yourself questioning why you went that route initially. Whereas if we were able to get corporates that want to drive a lot of innovation in their brand, or even just want to innovate using their resources into other segments, bringing more startups into proof of concepts and experiments, gosh, you would give a lot more scale to these startups with, you know, like one of our biggest complaints as a medium-sized scale-up, I guess, or startup, is we don't have enough data. You know, like we could go and do a project for a medium-sized company or deploy our product for a medium-sized company, but it'd be so much better if we had 20 million customer records in the platform, because it makes the model so much more predictable, right, with the scale of data, particularly when you're using neural techniques, because you need as much data as possible to understand all the impacts of all the features. And we'd love to be able to walk into, you know, a Telstra or a bank and say, you know, we think we could do this. Sure, go over to the lab and do a POC with us, because that's an area we really wanted to explore. And that's not easy. So it's a long way of saying, I reckon actually the education and the efforts that corporates could go to create a bit more experimentation, whether it's a labs function or a experimentation domain, would be probably the biggest area we could innovate down here in Oz to help the scale up and startup community.
No, definitely. I do like that model, what you're thinking with the corporate model involvement. We've heard a lot, Carl and I, last couple of episodes of different models, especially from government involvement versus corporate and high net worths, obviously. But that's I like it. It's good.
Yeah, it's a good. I mean, not to say that doesn't exist, right? IRG have labs. You know, a number of them do. AGL has an awesome program, Next, that just launched. You know, imagine if every corporate had carved out a bit of its headspace for supporting startups. It might even take equity in the startup if it applies, right? If it works, and they're getting a multiple on return because that startup's ideally targeting a problem they want to solve. They're not going to just stick capital into a project with a bunch of people to start from scratch, and they potentially have the upside of the startup becoming a scale up and globally expanding. I mean, everyone wins in that sort of experimental mindset.
No, definitely. Carl and I were discussing that with Singapore government take a cut of their businesses there too. So
yeah. Singapore's very innovative in this space. I mean, yeah, we're a little bit, behind's not fair, but we're a little bit constrained in our thinking in that respect.
Yeah. Absolutely. I guess the other issues we've got here as well, being a big country with the infrastructure, you know, capabilities that are behind, where I guess, like, you know, take telco, for example, right, where Singtel and Star and those guys can cover most of the island, you know, with, you know, like a tenth of the towers of what we need to cover our regional areas. It makes investment, I guess, in people much more risk averse. They don't want to sort of, you know, outlay a lot of money for potentially a longer return as well compared to internationally. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure is a different game altogether. I mean, that's a very long-term play, as you say, because you, with 28 million people or whatever we are, and the size of geography, you know, they have to have very long-term view of the return on those assets. But with software, right, we can roll in and prove out use cases and proofs of concepts in a couple of months, and then you just do a kind of a model off the back of that and say, well, what if that was applied nationally across the whole ecosystem, what would that do to productivity or to efficiency or to revenues or better user experience, so that consumers wanted to buy more and drive a bit more consumption?
Absolutely. Sort of use targeted cities as a rollout model and then scale from there. So fantastic. Well, Matt, it's been absolutely amazing having you on board today. We really appreciate you coming and sharing your insights. For everyone who is listening, we will be providing all of Matt's links, including links to Source AI, as well as Matt's LinkedIn and any other components as well. But on behalf of myself and Michael, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we'd love to get you back with Dennis probably to discuss some more AI panel discussions in the future as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. Yeah, no, I really appreciate it, guys. Thanks for the opportunity, and I love the podcast. It's awesome. Definite fan. I'm subscribed.
Wonderful. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Matt. Have a wonderful day, and we'll definitely chat soon.
All right, cheers,
mate.